Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
What's up, guys? You're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We record episodes and interview the very best experts from around the world and cover topics relating to health, success, mindset, business, and even social issues. And each week, we give you some of the best advice and information on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. Your elite life begins now. On today's episode, episode number 358, entitled, How to Conquer Adversity No Matter How Dire the Situation, I chat with Peter Sage. Peter Sage is an international serial entrepreneur, best-selling author, and expert in human behavior. In today's episode, Peter talks about how he survived being incredibly successful and wealthy to being sent to prison just a few years back. He breaks down his mentality going in, why he wasn't afraid, and how he got along great with all the other inmates and even changed many of their lives while being locked up. If you're wondering how to flip the script in life and not be brought down by dire circumstances, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. So after a lot of requests the last 2 years or so, we've actually been putting together something really incredible the last couple of months, and it will be launched soon. And that is a way for you to make money selling Elite Life Nutrition products. So you're helping out a great cause, you're supporting the podcast, and you also get to make a good amount of money by helping us out and becoming an affiliate of Elite Life Nutrition. Now, it is a process to apply, and we're working out some of the details, the final details, on getting it all set up for you guys. And not everybody is actually going to be allowed to do this. We are going to be very selective on the process, but we are giving it and allowing the option for many of you guys to reach out and apply. So the application process will be coming very soon, within the next couple of weeks. But in the meantime, I do want to just see who is interested in the opportunity, who would actually like to sell Elite Life Nutrition products for us and get a good chunk of money in return for doing that. So if you have any bit of following, if you have a lot of friends and family who take supplements, or you think they'd be interested in taking our products, or if you have a good social media following, or even websites and an email list, any of that type of thing, you definitely could be an option, and we'd love to see if you're interested in selling our products and becoming part of the team. So if you are, all I'm asking right now isn't to fill out the application, but just to shoot me an email or message on Instagram or Facebook for that matter, and just let me know that you're interested. And then from there, in the next week or two, I'll send you guys an application. So at this point, if you are interested in making some good money and selling our incredible Elite Life Nutrition products, shoot me an email at justin@elitemanmagazine.com, or shoot me a message on Instagram at Justin Stenstrom, or on Facebook, my Facebook as well, which I believe is, actually I always forget this name, but I believe it's at elitemanmag, which is the one I actually check for messages. You can friend me on that. You can shoot me a DM it's Facebook at Elite Man Mag, M-A-G on Facebook. So at Justin Stenstrom on Instagram, and also the email justin@elitemanmagazine.com, and let me know that you're interested and we'll take it from there. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from Elite Man Magazine, and my guest today is Peter Sage. Peter, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
No, pleasure here, and I'm glad we can make it happen, and looking forward to the ride.
Yeah, I know. It's been a couple of times that we mixed up schedules and stuff, and it's good, though. We're finally here and ready to rock, and
You have such an interesting story. I remember reading back on it that you're doing a lot of different things. And so it seems like you were successful at one point. Then you had like a screw up. You went to jail for a bit or prison. And then you sort of reformed your life to the point where you were helping a lot of these prisoners that you were in with. And now you're, you know, this great speaker, seminar speaker, entrepreneur. I know you went back and started helping those guys even after you were out of prison, but can you just dive in and give us a quick little sort of 60 second, two minute rundown on like what it is you're doing right now and how you get to this point?
Yeah, sure. I mean, my background is serial entrepreneur, you know, dropped out of school at 16, built 27 international companies. You know, some worked, some failed majestically, some wiped me out, some were success stories, the usual stuff, you know, typical entrepreneur, right? And then, yeah, six so years ago, I got hit with a civil action by a multi-billion dollar company over a multi-million dollar level of business that we'd done years before. And as a result of that, I ended up as a civil prisoner in jail, never been accused of a crime, still no criminal record, and went from kind of hero to zero, minus a third of a million in legal costs and all that kind of stuff, lost my business, property, all that, blah, all that kind of stuff. And started an amazing adventure on seeing if I could help people on the inside. And then when I came out, yeah, just build the business back up from being that far in the hole to seeing if I could apply everything I've been teaching for the last few years again in real life.
Yeah. It seems like you did pretty well too, because a lot of people that go to prison, you know, it kind of ruins their lives and the mental torture, the mental frustration, the loss of going from such a high place where you had multi-millions, it seems like, and then you lose that all. And you're basically thrown into a cell with, you know, not much to do. You don't have any money anymore. It's obviously probably scary, not just mentally, but physically. Like you're thinking you might get into fights. You're going to have to, you know, adjust your whole lifestyle. What is that like when you hear that news? How did you deal with such a devastating blow?
It was all about getting to a place of understanding what was going on, accepting. Yeah, you can't change anything that's already happened. And we hear so many people that get trodden down because they lose their business, their home, their marriage, their health, whatever it is. Resenting what's already happened is stupid because you can't change what's already happened. And so putting in resistance to what is basically wastes energy on what could be then freed up to channel into the next best move. Now, when I got sent down, I'm like, well, okay, I can't change that. Yeah, I'm not going to tunnel out of jail. So what's the best thing that I can do? Well, the best thing I can do is to frame it in a way that empowers me, not disempowers me. You know, and at that point, I'd been lucky. I'd had probably 25 years of being able to change millions of people's lives and suddenly realized that the people whose lives I could probably help the most maybe never get to see my work because they're in somewhere like jail. So, you know, if this is a way for me to be able to go and hold a candle for people that would never normally be in the dark, and that's what life wants me to do, what am I up for the challenge? And as soon as I started focusing on making it about helping others than sitting on the pity pot, I felt completely different. I got a mission. Yeah, I was on purpose again with something, even though it wasn't the purpose I thought I was going to have a week before when I was, you know, running a 50 staff, you know, multi six figure a month business, and thinking, you know, oops, you know, what do I do now? You know, I went from 50 staff to 3 staff in like 3 minutes. I was, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal debt and lost everything. But I can't change that. I can only deal with it the best way I can. And yeah, you may go through a little bit of period of just like, you know, take a breath and, oh, crap, didn't see that coming. But the faster you can get back on the horse and focus on a direction with some level of purpose that's not about you, but something bigger than you, the faster you can turn things around. And yeah, that was really my focus going in. I didn't know what was going to happen. I'd never been in prison before. I'd only ever seen it on stuff like movies and Prison Break and that kind of stuff. And it was statistically the most violent prison in the UK. I mean, we got a murder a couple of, you know, weeks before I arrived. We got attempted murders every week. I mean, it was this wasn't a joke. Yeah, this wasn't a holiday camp. And why? Yeah, I never felt in danger because I was there to serve and I wasn't there to barter. I wasn't there to try to prove a point, nothing. I was on a mission. I was there to help people. I was an undercover secret agent of change. And as a result of that, yeah, I ended up getting a lot of the prisons off drugs. I was stopping suicides. I was, yeah, redesigning the intake system to reduce violence and help foster relationships between the wings. It's now being used in prisons all over the world, including thousands of prisons in the US. I won a national award while I was in there for the work that I did. And yeah, I came out after 6 months, still financially devastated in the hole. I mean, I'd never been about a third of a million in debt at that point. No credit rating, no business, no assets, no nothing. And I got excited. I'm like, wow, I never dug myself out of a hole this deep before. Let's swing the bat, see what happens. It was that kind of attitude.
Wow. So it seemed like it ended up being a blessing in disguise for you with this new outlook on life.
I've been teaching positive psychology for 25 years. Okay. And I'm a great believer that, it's what I call, it's in the first letter that I wrote to my students from inside was, guys, don't worry about me. We will star in the movie of our life. I'm just on location for 6 months filming the prison scene. And, for me, it was what I call a graduation event. Yeah, if you're a health coach, expect to get a health challenge so you can walk your talk. If you're a relationship coach, expect to have relationship challenges so that you can demonstrate you're authentic about what you teach and not just, talking a good game when the sun's shining. There's a lot of people that think they can be good sailors on calm seas. But, when it comes to stepping up, we're here to grow, and we grow through challenge. The strongest trees don't grow in the best soil. They're not the best, the ones that had the best parents or went to the best school. The strongest trees grow in the strongest winds. And we don't get to choose those. So life chooses it for us. And for me being in there, it was definitely a graduation event. And so I was there to just try to do the best I can.
Yeah. What had led you in your life, what had led up to the point for 25 years, like you said, where you were conditioning your mindset for this type of thing to happen? So if it did happen to you, like something, I mean, obviously you didn't forecast prison being in your future, but something equally as devastating or among those lines of adversity. What were you doing to get to that point prior to that? You said 25 years of this stuff, but like, what made you want to get into that? What were some of the things that you were doing personally to condition yourself?
Yeah, because it's not really kind of preparing for stuff like that. You never want to specifically plan or prepare as such. It's really evolving into a place where that's who you become when it happens. And for me, that started when I was 17 years old. I dropped out of school at 16. I've got my formal qualifications. I started my first business at 17, but I also got into personal growth. I discovered that at 17 years old. It was a blessing. I'm like, whoa, hang on a minute. You mean there's an industry that teaches you how to be successful and make money and achieve goals? Where the hell was that in school? Yeah. That's what I really wanted to learn, not the periodic freaking table. Right? So I threw myself, I was never smart. I wasn't book smart. I wasn't school smart. I wanted to get out there and sort of learn. And when I found this industry called personal growth, I threw myself at it. Now, being completely honest and transparent, the reasons I threw myself into it was because I was desperate to try to prove that I was good enough to avoid the insecurities as a young man that I wasn't. I was in the classic achiever, striving to try to prove to the world I could make it, not because I didn't realize at that point that the world didn't give a shit. The world doesn't care. 80% of people don't care about your problems. The other 20% are glad you have them. It's about me just dealing with the insecurities. And so for the first, I would say probably 10 years, up to about 27, it was all about, probably less, probably about 25. It was all about trying to achieve more. I was on the quest to 10X everything, as the phrase as it goes today. Thanks, Grant. It was a two-edged sword. On the good side, it made me financially successful. I was a millionaire in my early 20s. I was buying Ferraris for cash. I was flying Concorde. I was doing all this stuff. I was flying around the world doing 20 countries a year and all this kind of stuff. I had successful businesses. Massively miserable, unfulfilled, and zero joy, total stress. And I remember I was being at my first major Tony Robbins seminar. At that point, I never realized that I'd end up working with him for 15 years as one of his experienced trainers.
Oh, nice.
But at that time, I remember saying to one of his team, I'm like, I'm not here because I want to achieve goals. I know how to achieve goals. You show me a goal, I can achieve anything. The question is, why am I still achieving it? And I was chasing that hamster wheel to know, get into the top of Success Mountain and then you finally arrive and want to jump off because, what you think is there isn't. And that was the time I finally realized there was a massive difference between a life chasing success and a life chasing fulfillment. And that was really the starting point of switching my focus in personal growth from being able to try to master skills to achieve goals to mastering myself. And really it was from there that I started developing a much more, holistic, empowering model of the world. So no matter what happens in the outside world, We can roll with the punches. We can flow with the bends in the river. Rather than trying to control everything, get stressed out, which I'd done for nearly 10 years and nearly killed myself doing it. Make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. What was it like working with Tony Robbins for 10 years, I think you said it was?
Well, 15 years, to be fair. 15. I mean, in 2002, I was very privileged to become his youngest serving trainer. And my role really with a small group of elite trainers was to facilitate in the events, the big events that he does, like that. You've probably seen I'm Not Your Guru, and that's a date with destiny. I've done 12, 13 of those events where we're essentially doing on the ground what Tony's doing on stage, because we're managing the team, we're responsible for their outcomes, we're dealing with psychotherapeutic interventions, we're getting people off drugs, we're dealing with past traumas and that kind of stuff. So I had a pretty good grounding of understanding behaviors and making rapid change in others, which was a massive skill set that allowed me to add a lot of value in prison. Now, don't get me wrong, I say it kind of tongue-in-cheek, but I met a lot more crazies in seminars than I did in Pentonville. Right. Yeah. So, that was like another day in the office. But, I was trained a lot in, taught myself a lot as well. I mean, it was my focus was human behavior, not achievement. I've worked with people worth $700 million that are miserable as hell and on antidepressants because they're not a billionaire yet. Yeah, that's a tunnel with no cheese. That's never ever going to end. I've been there. Yeah, when I make my first million, I'll be happy. Well, no, I made my first million. I was upset. Why? I was stressed out of my mind because now I've got fear of loss, so I've got to make 2 million in case I lose the first. That game never ends. So, really just figuring out that what's the game about? What makes us get up in the morning excited or not excited? What makes us, sort of smile at a sunset rather than miss it because I'm stuck in my thoughts? And really human behavior became my passion rather than how do I achieve something else? And that's really what gave me the grounding to be able to walk into prison smiling and walk out having changed thousands of lives and do things that I'm sort of proud of to be extent, not because I care about what other people think, but to try to pass a little bit of my own tests in earth school, as it were.
Yeah. Did you really walk in smiling, though? Like you weren't nervous at all on the first day?
The only nervous part about it was I remember walking down the stairs thinking, right, okay, I've got to pick a frame of empowerment here and fast, because if I go in as an identity of a prisoner, I'm done. So I went, I never saw myself as a prisoner. And again, I wasn't a criminal. I was the only non-criminal in the entire jail. Non-segregated. I was treated exactly the same as everybody else.
Wow.
But I went in as a secret agent of change. I was an undercover Jedi. That was my kind of secret label. And my first mission was underneath the courthouse before they took me to jail. You've got like the holding cells. And again, I'm seeing stuff I've only ever seen on TV here. And the people, the staff were just miserable. They're used to complaining, angry criminals, people that are like, screaming at the judge, people that are like, hopefully were walking out and now just been sent out. All that, you get the idea.
Yeah.
And these people are just numb. They clearly don't like their job. They just cope with it. They get abuse constantly. I'm like, wow, my mission before I leave the courthouse is to make every one of the guards I see smile. How do I bring light to that? How do I bring levity to a place where it's usually dark? Yeah, how do I acknowledge them and thank them for the role that they're playing in this rather than resent them for me being in here? So that was literally walking down the stairs, that was the attitude. And then when I got to prison, there were two people, the first two people I really spoke to. One was the prison officer that gave me my clothes and checked me in. And he leaned forward, he says, "Are you a police officer?" And I'm like, no, and please don't give me that label walking in. that's not conducive to life expectancy, And then when I had my medical before they gave me a cell and banged me up with some other guy, the prison doctor and I were chatting, and he says, "Can I ask you a question?" I said, "Sure." He says, "Are you undercover?" And I smiled at him and I laughed. I says, "Well, no." I says, "But what makes you ask that? You're the second person that's mentioned it." He's gone, "I've never in 30 years of being a prison doctor ever met somebody that was so happy on their first ever day in prison." And I took that as a compliment.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. It wasn't all smiles. There was some tough times in there. But again, where do you live? Where do you visit? I know a lot of people that live in depression and occasionally visit happiness. I'd much rather live in happiness and occasionally get upset. That's a choice. But that's a conditioning choice that you have to build yourself. Look at your body. How do you get the body you get? You condition it. Yeah, if you live in McDonald's and visit the gym, it's not going to, once in a while, it's not going to do anything. If you live in the gym, you can visit McDonald's once in a while, it's not going to do anything. Get the point?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think though that some people would, because there are like you said, there's a time and a place for certain things, and even your emotions, there's a time to be down at times, to be a little upset. It can be it can propel you into making changes. But in that lifestyle, when everybody around you, especially the prisoners, you know, you're going in there smiling because you know you're going to be all right, and you've conditioned yourself for so many years to be able to handle such a thing, and you're at this place where you're, you know, mentally like this Jedi. Are you a little worried that you being in a good mood, being happy, perhaps smiling, and even making a joke with some of the people that work there might lead to resentment from other prisoners seeing you? Is they're probably in there for a lot longer. You said it was the most violent prison. I'm sure a lot of those guys are in there for life. If it is, you know, they're seeing someone come in there all happy and, you know, seemingly cool on the outside. Did you worry about that maybe irritating them or rubbing them the wrong way?
Yeah, well, it's, you've got to have some level of sensory acuity and sanity here. I mean, again, I wasn't waltzing in there as like a cocky, arrogant, confident guy. Yeah, that's a fast track to getting a spiked toothbrush sticking out of your neck. Yeah, the sensory acuity was high. Again, I'd never said this was an alien environment for me at all, but I was on the lookout for ways to add value. I was on the lookout for people I could help with the skill set that I have. Not, you know, walk around saying, hey, you know, why don't you cheer up, you Muppet? Because, like, you know, life can be better. That ain't going to work. Right? So, no, to totally get that. And it has to be a level of humility and empathy and authenticity that accompanies that desire to want to add value, to desire to be able to help. Because, again, you've got many people in there that were, you know, lifers that are in for long stretches that, you know, were just having a tough time. And, yeah. It was after a little while when I got established as on the wing, and people kind of realized I became the unofficial prison social worker, you know, for a while. And I was helping people write letters, you know, to their family. I was helping people, you know, construct, you know, apologies for the appeal and things like that. And I didn't want anything for it in return. You know, prison is a barter system with some high interest rates, you know, and everything costs something. And I was there to help. I was just there to seriously add value. I didn't need anything. Yeah, so I think that helped a lot when people started to understand that I was a resource. I wasn't some cocky guy walking in, and I could genuinely help, and I had a skill set that was, you know, I got people off drugs, I was stopping suicides. I said, it's like, yeah, people would come to me for help, knowing that, yeah, it's not going to cost them, and so that really helps. But I mean, like I say, it wasn't always rose. I mean, my second cellmate threatened to smash the TV in my face because, you know, I wouldn't entertain his "I'm a victim" sob story. Yeah, to an extent. And yeah, called a bit of tough love. I mean, he was twice my size. But yeah, that was the point where I thought, oh, yeah, remember where you are. You know, and many times where you have to remind yourself. But I never really felt in danger, even though there was a lot of blood on the floor around me, because I wasn't there to prove anything. I wasn't there to conquer anything. I wasn't there to defend anything. I was literally, say, filming the prison scene of my movie for 6 months on location.
Nice. How did you handle that particular moment there when the giant guy wanted to smash the TV in your face? How did you de-escalate and make things okay with him?
You align and redirect. Yeah, if you start to challenge, that's going to, you know, force attracts counterforce. Power comes from a different place. There's a big difference between power and force. Yeah, you want an example of that? Look at Gandhi. All right, you've got one guy in a loincloth that weighs about the same as your headset, all right, that is going up against 1 million armed British soldiers. If he'd have tried force and picked up a gun, that'd have squashed him like a bug. But the guy, yeah, was able to essentially dismantle the largest empire on earth at that point, just by being who he was, coming from a place of power, non-violence, and, you know, immovable will. Not through riling up riots, not through attending anti-British rallies, none of that stuff. That's force versus force. So power has a different theme to it. And coming from a place where, yeah, he was, I wasn't entertaining. I'd been listening to it for an hour. We're both lying. I was on the top bunk. He was on the bottom bunk. And he was like, blah, 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 blah. And yeah, and I'm like, his name was Mark. I'm like, Mark, listen, I'm done. All right. I'm not, yeah, you're better than this. Right. We've already spoke about how there's nothing you're going to do shouting at this freaking wall or the guards that freaking walk by every 20 seconds is going to help anybody. All right. well, what do you fucking know? Blah, 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 blah. In fact, you know something? Yeah, I think I should just rip the TV off the wall and smash it in your face when you're asleep. And I'm like, okay, at this point, yeah, you're line redirect. Say, well, listen, I'm here to support you. Right. Yeah. And yeah, if that's how you feel, then let's chat in the morning. I'm not going to push. I'm not going to try to be addicted to being right. I don't have an ego that's got to be defended. Yeah. And yeah, I listened to another hour of him screaming at the door and whatever. And yeah, remembered that that this place probably wouldn't do that well on TripAdvisor.
Caldera Lab has high-performance men's skincare, and it combines pharmaceutical-grade science, nature's purest and most potent ingredients, and sustainable business practices. They have a product called The Good, which is a clinically proven, multifunctional, non-toxic formula of 27 active botanicals meticulously infused over 4 weeks in an EcoCert Cosmos-certified facility. It's formulated with wild-harvested, non-GMO, and organic ingredients, and is a lightweight, all-in-one treatment designed to restore, nourish, and protect a man's skin. Caldera Lab is the first men's skincare in the USA to be certified by both EcoCert and Made Safe. I've tried The Good now for a number of weeks and I absolutely love it. I gotta be honest, I wasn't quite sure if I'd love it because I'm not a huge skincare guy and I haven't taken a ton of different skincare products in the past. Although I've taken a few, I didn't really love the results I got with them. But after taking The Good for just a couple of days, I noticed almost right away how more refreshed and nourished and just overall better looking my skin felt and looked. The Good really is that good, and that's why I'm recommending it for you guys to take as well. It really is, in my personal opinion, the very best skincare product for men on the market. And by the way, GQ agrees with me as well. They call it the best natural face serum for men. So whether you're tackling dry skin, acne scars, wrinkles, or just want to do you and invest in healthier skin, kind of like me, this is the one product I recommend using. To try it right now, I'm telling you, you're going to absolutely love this serum. It is incredible, but for whatever reason, if you don't love it, there is a 100% risk-free guarantee. So if you don't love it, you can send it back, get a full refund. Right now, Caldera has a special offer for our audience. Receive 20% off your first Caldera Lab purchase of The Good. Go to calderalab.com and use discount code ELITEMAN, one word, all caps, at checkout. That's CALDERALAB.com and use the code ELITEMAN for 20% off your first order.
And so did you kind of de-escalated in that moment and then came back to it the next morning and it was, you guys are on better terms?
That was the point I knew that my time in there was done. I'd spent 3 weeks with this guy and I'd helped a lot. He was upset about his weight. His family wasn't writing to him. I wrote a letter for him to copy to his wife that got a response and a visit. We got an incel exercise routine where we were supporting each other. And I had a negative talk kind of free zone because he was watching your typical Jeremy Kyle, Jimmy Springer, whatever it is, Springer.
Jerry Springer.
Daytime TV bullshit, watching it. I'm that does not live anywhere within a billion miles of my universe, So we had kind of an agreement initially on a negative free zone or whatever. But again, he was kind of a pressure cooker. I was able to diffuse a lot of time it built up. And asking questions is a great way to break somebody's pattern. Yeah, again, align and redirect. Yeah, I just knew at that point that my time was done.
Yeah.
So I got out. Now, the interesting thing is literally within 24, 48 hours of me leaving the cell, he had a psychotic meltdown. And I saw from my cell, which is now on the opposite side of the wing, I saw five officers in riot gear charge in to get him out in restraints. And they took him to the mental health care wing. And an officer actually came to see me afterwards and to get a report saying, listen, you've just been locked up with this guy for a couple of weeks. What can you tell us? And I gave her, my thoughts and whatever, but their consensus was, he was a bit of a pressure cooker. No other cellmate had got on with him. Why they put me in there, I don't know, but probably the universe had done that to try to help at some level. Yeah. And I was able to be a bit of a damper or release valve on that. But again, if number one rule of coaching, if you want something more for somebody than they want it for themselves, you are wasting your time.
Yeah. 100%. I've learned that over the years too. Some people you just can't help because they don't want to help themselves.
Some people are very happy being unhappy.
Yeah.
Some people are very happy staying as a victim in their own movies, and they want to star in a horror show and a drama. And the toughest thing is if it's someone you care about. But one has to remember that sometimes people have to hit their head on the sidewalk in order to learn how to tie their shoelaces.
Yeah.
So we have no right to take their lessons away. We can only be the example and the invitation.
Yeah. So you transferred out of there, and basically this guy was a ticking time bomb. 48 hours later, so he's having a mental breakdown. And so is it tough though when you're in a place like that where there is a lot of people, and I don't know the numbers, the percentage wise, but I'm sure a significant amount of the population in prison has some type of mental health thing going on. Is it tough to deal with those types of people who may not be completely sane when you come across them? If you're going to at least Tony Robbins seminars, or you're working there, at least these people haven't gotten to the point where they're, you know, in a place like prison where it's dangerous and they seemingly have lost a lot of things and they don't handle it like you've handled it. So they can get even worse down this rabbit hole of mental health issues and problems. And you might not be speaking to someone who's all in, who's entirely there. How do you deal with those types of people who may not be open to receive the type of information that you have?
There was two categories there. One was prescription drugs, and the government's own stats show that 1 in 5 people in Pentonville were on antipsychotic medication. 1 in 5, 20% of the prisons.
Yeah.
But by far the biggest issue was non-prescription drugs. Yeah, spice, mamba, crack, meth. I mean, it was almost to order. Yeah, the drones would keep me awake at night at 4 a.m. delivering drugs to cells.
Yeah, what's that? What's a drone?
A drone, like, you know, like a camera drone.
Oh, yeah, they have those?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yes, yeah, all of the prisons are stepping up. They were caught a bit flat-footed a couple of years back, and now a lot of them have netting, and they have anti-drone devices to block the signals that people are controlling from their phones and what have you. But drugs are smuggled in so many inventive ways. Mm. They actually estimate 2% of prison officers double or triple their income just by smuggling drugs because, you know, they hate their job and, you know, they're on a pretty poor salary for, you know, the risks they take. So, yeah, you get it. It happens. But regardless of how it happens, drugs were rife. And when you're working with someone, you're looking to work with someone, it's the first thing you look for. Yeah, what's the pupil dilation? What's the breathing rate? What's the body language? What's the language patterns they're using? Yeah, all of this stuff I'm trained in terms of doing psychotherapeutic intervention. And so, yeah, if somebody's on drugs, you're essentially doing surface stuff. You're minimizing damage. They're not going to remember anything tomorrow, or they're too locked into their patterns. If their biochemistry is out of whack, best thing you can do is get them some water, get them hydrated, get them talking, yeah, and really play a role as if you're a really keen listener. Depending on which drug they're on, if they're on something like spice, they're a zombie out to the world. Forget it. It's, you know, just put them in the cell. You know, but if that's if you're on a break on the wing. But if they're, you know, if they're on marijuana, they're kind of chilled, etc. So therefore, some of the beliefs that they've got an edge on are somewhat softened. So that's a good time to open the door to shake some of the beliefs that they may have that are erroneous. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting environment, a laboratory to play in.
Yeah. What is spice? Is that heroin or fentanyl, something like that?
Spice is kind of a synthetic. I'd never heard of it until I went in. It's kind of like a synthetic upside. I just know people that are on it were.
That was the worst.
Yeah, so zombies pretty much. It turned them into zombies.
Wow.
Yeah, and in fact, it's pretty big. They might have a different name for it in the US, I don't know. But yeah, it got pretty big. When I came out, people started saying, oh yeah, in the city centers, that it's almost called Attack of the Zombies now. You'll see people just standing there like dead to the world with their head against the lamppost, just, you know, drooling. And yeah, Manchester, Birmingham, you'll see, it's on YouTube. You go to, you know, yeah, zombie spice, yeah, city center, and you'll see them. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. I guess it sounds like they're more like relaxed, but like, because they're so out of it. But there was another one too. I don't know if you've seen it a few years ago, where there was another like zombie drug they were talking about. It was like people taking bath salts and they turn into like psychos and just go crazy, like they couldn't be stopped. There was this one guy in Florida, I think, who was like biting some dude's face. Like, it was crazy. Like, they were doing crazy shit. And, you know, it's just like when someone's so out of it like that, it's like scary because they're not even able to have a conversation with you. They're not even able to comprehend what you're trying to say, or they may perceive you as a threat, or someone who also may have, like, say, schizophrenia or one of those, you know, deeper, darker mental health ones. If they're having an episode of that, it's like almost like they're not even there. Like their soul is
is gone somewhere else. So their, you know, cognitive facilities are not there.
On something like that, you look to enter their world.
Yeah.
If someone's schizophrenic and they've got bipolar, they've got two different personalities, you make them feel as if you're engaging with the one they're at. Right? You can put names on them. So, hey, who am I talking to today? Oh, it's Ben. Right? Ben, oh, I've been waiting to talk to you for an hour. Blah, blah, blah. Tell me what's going on with Ben. Right. And now they're in their own world. You've got them focused on them. Right, 2 hours later, they're back to being Jumbo. Right, and then you've got to enter their world. And I learned this from an intervention I did. No, I didn't do actually at a Tony Robbins event many years ago. It kind of became part of the train of folklore. And this was a time when I was on part of the leadership team where I'm kind of an apprentice trainer. I want to be a trainer. I'm not there yet. I'm learning. But I'm a senior leader and I'm on the path. And somebody comes running into the staff room and says, we need a trainer, we need a trainer. And yeah, I'm a senior leader, I'm good enough. I'm like, I'll go, I'll handle it. What's up? Says there's a woman out in the corridor kicking off. This is the main event with 1,000 people, but in the main ballroom where Tony's speaking, but in the sort of corridor at the side where you got the vendors and stuff, this woman's kicking, screaming. I'm walking, a big crowd of people around her, and I've gone walking up. And she's kicking chairs and screaming that effing bloody whatever minded and all this kind of stuff. Now, when you go to somebody like that, I need to break their pattern. Best way to break somebody's pattern is ask them a question. Questions direct focus. Questions are the steering wheel of the mind. Yeah, even asking someone, excuse me, what's your middle name? Yeah, can stop somebody in their tracks. They're like, that was angry. Hang on, what do you mean? And they're out of state for a second. There's many different ways. That's an easy example. So I'm walking up to this woman and I'm trying to lock on a strategy. And I get within about, I don't know, 6-8 feet. I'm through the crowd. I'm walking to her and she stops. She looks at me dead in the eyes. She starts clasping her hands around her throat, squeezing so she can hardly breathe. Oh my God, points one finger at me and screams, it's him. Stop the dark angel. He's going to take me back to the mothership. Now, at which point my pattern was completely broken. What? I lost all of my certainty. And at that moment, two trainers, experienced trainers, bless them, walked past and they just seamlessly took over this situation. They entered her world. They banished this dark angel into a freaking prism of light and disconnected from the mothership or whatever and got her down, got her talking, got her calm. And within 5 minutes, she's a normal woman. I'm like, wow, that's cool shit. How do you do that? And that's when one part of my emphasis for really wanting to be a trainer and learn from there. But yeah, that was an interesting episode, which forever known in trainer folklore is the alien chick episode. But you've got to be careful. But entering their world is what did it. And I remember that when I was in prison, when people were having these different personality or psychotic episodes, and you'd align with them so they didn't feel threatened or that they had to prove who they were talking to or anything like that.
Yeah. That makes so much sense. That's really cool. And what is the language pattern thing? I've heard this over and over again. I know it's like an NLP thing. Can you just explain what that is and how that works?
Well, I mean, you're spotting cues based upon the language they're looking that they're using. And again, that could be if you're looking for where they sit on the kind of levels of consciousness. Are they more victim mentality? Is it all about things happening to them? Yeah, is it more achiever mentality where they're making things happen? Yeah, is it all about confrontational levels of language? Yeah, where they're essentially justifying the need for significance. Or is it, again, the modalities they use? Yeah, is it visual-based language? Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, the future is bright. You know, it's visual tagging. Or are they auditory? They're processing most of their external world through sound. It's like, oh, I hear what you're saying. Yeah, that clicks for me. Yeah, or are they more kinesthetic? They take the rough with the smooth. You get a feel for the temperature of, is this deal hot or not? Yeah, rather than, okay, this has to look good. You see the difference between visual, auditory, kinesthetic. So that just helps you build rapport with somebody in terms of a language pattern. But understanding where they calibrate at victim significance, what's driving them. Yeah, that's really what I'm listening for the most when it comes to language. What is their model of the world? What are their top driving needs? What do they value most? People give away so much information if you know what to look for. That's just on the visual cues and the verbal cues. The non-visual stuff is just as powerful. Again, you're talking about the energetic, the breathing stuff, the postures, the sense of how long it takes them to think their visual accessing cues, where their eyes move in between, you know, when they're thinking of or remembering stuff. A lot of different things that come out that, if you know what you're looking for, can tell you a huge amount of information. I mean, go speak to a professional poker player. You know, they'll tell you how much information people give away when they don't want to give information away.
Yeah, that's great. I got a couple of poker books too of reading people. I think his name's Caro. He wrote like the first like body language one, and it was like a huge hit. It's kind of like, you know, one of the classics in the poker world. But there's so many things, and you know, you're reading this book, and it's like you would never have thought that there was half the things that people do when they're doing, and just the subtlest movements, the way they talk, the way they move their hand when they're putting their chips in, the way they might look over after they make a move, after they make a call. It's just incredible how much we reveal. And, you know, they say like upwards of 93% of communication is nonverbal. I don't know if it's that high, but it's certainly really high. And people are giving away all this information without even realizing it.
Certainly 93%, I'd say, is non-conscious.
Yeah.
Nonverbal, but certainly non-conscious. We're you know, habit machines. We do, you know, a lot out of passion, not a lot out of logic, but, you know, vast majority of what we do out of habit. So we're not even aware. That's not even up for debate. The last time you pulled up to work on your day off will tell you that, and you wouldn't know, you know, what happened to the last 3 miles while you were driving. So, yeah, it's just how we're wired evolutionarily. It's useful. Yeah, we don't have to learn to walk every day. But if you can continue to build ganglia and neural networks in the brain to a certain level of habit, because we've got a frontal cortex, evolution says, well, you're making smart decisions because you've got a front part of your brain animals don't have. Therefore, if you make that same decision over and over, it's got to be good for you. So, you know, you order the fries instead of the salad too often, now you don't even think about it. Yeah, so yeah, there's lots we could unpack on that on many rabbit holes, I'm sure.
Yeah. At what point do you sort of put your influence into the situation when you're communicating with somebody and try to steer it towards what you want? So I know you're doing a lot of listening, a lot of questioning, asking them different questions and building rapport. At what point do you kind of flip the script and start leading the conversation and the agenda of what you want to get done?
Well, the outcome I'm going in with is to add value. Mm. Yeah, it's how can I serve? Now, again, there's the age-old debate. What's the difference between influence and manipulation? Well, I'll tell you, right? It isn't a skill set. It's exactly the same skill set. The difference is it serving you or serving them? If you're going in with the agenda to get something and you use a certain skill set, then you're going to manipulate that situation to your advantage. If you're going in with the outcome to try to add value to the person or do what you believe in your heart to be best for that person, then yeah, you can use the same skills to influence the outcome, but it's not about you. Now, obviously in prison, there's a lot of people doing both, but you know, more on the egocentric side than the ethnocentric side. But for me, I'm already there with the agenda of how can I serve, how can I add value, what's going on here, is there a space for me to be able to work some magic if I can, or you know, at least help. Or so I'm always filtering the data that's coming back through that, formulating a game plan, formulating an action plan, formulating the next steps, or residing the fact that you know, now's not the time. So the best time to start in what you'd call flipping the script actively would be before, long enough that they've given enough intel for you to make an informed decision, or to, you know, to put enough pieces of the jigsaw together as to what's going on, and long enough that they feel that they've been heard and therefore understood, so you're not jumping the gun, but not long enough that they get more into their own story and start reinforcing the pattern, because now they're using it as a way to justify why they're a victim or why they're right or whatever. Makes sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it's the perfect timing that has to come into play there. And build enough rapport, but then get to the point where you're ready to flip the script and move on to what you want to do. It's coming from a place of serving, though, too, which isn't like, you know, you said a manipulation type of thing where it's like, I want to manipulate you to get my outcome. It's more like I want to change how you're thinking and get you off this track of, you know, being negative and leading yourself into this self-fulfilling prophecy of, you know, poor endings.
I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
I was with one guy, and he was upset. He was from Bangladesh, and he'd come over, saved up, his family had chipped all their money in to put him into college in the UK. And yeah, better prospects than Bangladesh, but expensive. And that's a big, big chunk for a family out of Bangladesh. So he came, the college went bankrupt, taking all his money. Now he's only there on a student visa, but now he feels really indebted to his family because if he goes back, they've lost everything. He's got no education. So he starts working in England, yeah, somewhat illegally because he doesn't have a working visa, to try to make money. And anyway, he got caught and he got sent to jail. Now, his dream was to be an entrepreneur. And he'd actually done some pretty cool things before he got caught to try to set up his business. But now he felt like a failure. And he was telling me his story. And I got enough data points, but he was doing it as a way to sort of justify why he was a victim. Now, at that point, a great way to segue is to, once you're connected and you're listening, and they know someone knows when you're listening or when you're just waiting to talk, right? Whether you're in an intervention or whether you're in a relationship or whatever, conversation, business deal. So if a great segue is, oh, I get it. And in fact, do you mind if I ask you a question? And that as an interface allows them to say, yeah, oh, you're asking a question because you want to know more about what it is that they're doing. So it's not as if you're hijacking the conversation. Yeah, their defenses are down a little bit.
Yeah.
But at that point, I say, I'm asking you a question. I answer that. What would have to happen for you to think that you're a successful entrepreneur? He's going, well, I have to have a successful business. I'm like, okay, what makes you say that? Huh? I said, well, see, an entrepreneur for me is about being identical. I've just lost everything. But I don't consider myself a failure. In fact, failures are the things I get excited about because they're my capital. I said, so if you're waiting to have a successful business in order to call yourself an entrepreneur, you're putting the cart before the horse. Because yeah, you're going to be a wantrepreneur for the rest of your life. Because if you don't see yourself as a successful entrepreneur, you're not going to attract any successful opportunities. Because you know, that's what successful entrepreneurs attract. So if you see yourself as an entrepreneur, regardless of what the outer world does in terms of the current business status, yeah, or prison, and says, yeah, I've just lost everything. Do you want to ask me if I still see myself as an entrepreneur? I was a born entrepreneur. It's what I do. It's who I am. It's not validated by my self-worth and my net worth being erroneously tied together. No. So I said, you know, tell me what are some of the characteristics of a successful entrepreneur? Oh, well, you'd have, you know, ability to handle uncertainty. It's a big one. The ability to take risks, the, you know, being able to, you know, do things that some people say you're crazy about. I said, hang on, mate, you came to England. You hardly spoke the language at the time. You took a big risk. Yeah. And I listed four or five things that he just identified. I says, you're more of an entrepreneur than I am. Do you mind if I ask you some advice? Yeah. And he's like, his jaw dropped. Never seen it that way. But if I'd let him get into his victim story at that point, it would have been, he would have missed the awareness.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love that. Can I ask you for tips? And then he's like, you know, he's giving you advice now and you've just instantly made him believe that he's an incredible entrepreneur and he has that new mindset.
Completely destroyed his whole reference for what it was by pulling out the shaky legs it was under. There was no logic to it, but making him understand. Who you are is not what you do, right? Are you, if you're a fireman, are you no longer a fireman when there's no longer a fire? Or no, you're a fireman. And when a fire shows up, you go and do what it is. You're an entrepreneur. The fact you don't have a business right now, you don't have a fire to put out, no big deal. But who you are now is what counts. And that's what will direct your ability to spot opportunities, the ability to present yourself as a deal maker or as an entrepreneur or as somebody that's looking to take advantage of different things in the market rather than trying to find it so that you can finally call yourself an entrepreneur. Big shift.
Yeah. What do you think the most important skill was that you had going into prison? Do you think it was something like the NLP techniques that you have, the language pattern ability that you could pick up on, or hypnosis perhaps, or something?
No, I'm not a huge fan of hypnosis. I mean, it works. The thing you need for hypnosis is the fact you need to be able to trust who is hypnotizing you. Yeah. There's not a lot of trust in prison. Everyone's got a deal, an agenda, or a weapon in their back pocket. So, you know, you need to be able to relax and have your brain drop into a sub 7 hertz state, into theta, in order to be able to do that. And if you've got a good relationship with a therapist, then yeah, you can do that. And then your critical mind shut down, you can take embedded commands and suggestions. But it's not really, I have a lot of other tools I prefer to use. But I would say the biggest thing I had going for me was the primary skill of an entrepreneur, which again, I invited it to Mo. Mo was the gentleman's name. And that the biggest skill of an entrepreneur is the ability to handle uncertainty. Why? Because we don't know what we're going to get paid on Friday. We don't know if we're going to get paid on Friday. We don't know if we're going to be able to eat on Friday, right? Yeah, we eat last. So, yeah, and there's no guarantees there. So Tony Robbins said once something that was very profound. He said that the quality of a person's life is in direct proportion to the amount of uncertainty they can comfortably live with. Now, the key word for me out of that entire phrase was the word comfortably. Why? Because you have to live with uncertainty. There's no guarantees in life. You want a guarantee? Buy a toaster. Right? There's no guarantees. So if you're going to have to live with uncertainty, the more comfortable you can be with that. See, some people are trying to control everything. They can't even live in the space of a question. Well, good luck with trying to do that. Yeah, these are the people that are stressed out of their mind because they expect everybody else to be, do, act, or behave like they want them to be, do, act, or behave like. Well, yeah, you know, stop expecting you from other people. Right? So being able to have that ability for 25 years as an active entrepreneur, having swung the bat, struck out, home runs, won the baseball Super Bowl, whatever it is, and also been dropped off the team, and every part of the spectrum you can think of as an entrepreneur, it's what we do, right? Yeah, so there's not a lot that phases me at that point. And walking into prison with a mission to be able to go and act as a secret agent of change, as I said, when I came out, I was a third of a million in the hole with no credit rating, they wouldn't even give me a bank account. I've got no staff. I got nothing. I was excited. I've never dug myself out of a hole that deep. This should be fun. It's a different way. Again, I don't link my self-worth to my net worth. I'm not going to take it with me. You know, you go to Hollywood. If you're starring in the Fast and the Furious, you get to drive some pretty cool cars. You don't get to keep them at the end of the movie. Nobody takes the props with them. You know, the only people that tried that with the Egyptians and what happened, we dug it up and stole it. You know, so, you know, what does the game become? Why are you here? As I said, nobody wants to watch James Bond rescue a kitten out of a tree for 90 minutes. You go to a Bond movie because you want action and adventure and comedy and tragedy and romance and everything. And I want to get to the end of this movie, Justin, and turn around and say, wow, that's a movie I would pay to see again. That's the life I want to live. I'm not trying to barricade myself into a comfort zone because of my insecurities that caused me to run around in the outer world looking for somewhere else to reattach my umbilical cord. That ain't gonna work.
Yeah, that's incredible, man. It's been such a fascinating interview. I know we could go on and on. I know your time's limited and we got to wrap things up, but it's been fascinating, man. I really appreciate you coming on. What's the last send-off takeaway message you'd like to leave the Elite Man audience and a place our listeners can check out your work and your book and all the things you're up to right now?
Gotcha. Well, one of the things I mentioned is every 2 weeks while I was inside, I wrote letters, detailed letters to my students, trying to show them what I was doing. And it was kind of part journal, part how-to manual, part tradecraft, part, you couldn't make it up on a soap opera, but it was real. And when I came out, they said they'd learned more from those 11 letters. It changed their lives more than following around the world for 2 years on stage. And so we actually published the letters. And it's unique because it's not a book that I wrote afterwards. This is unfolding in real time. And it's literally just the 11 letters that I wrote to my students. And it's called The Inside Track. I'll show you there. And this retails for $24.95. It's won several awards. It went number one bestseller in literally 4 hours. It's changed the life of pretty much everybody that's read the book. And because of what's happened the last couple of years with the global situation, I want to try to get this book in as many people's hands as possible. So, being totally transparent, it costs me to have it printed, shipped to the warehouse in Ohio, stored, put into the mail system, and then posted. It cost me about $14. I set aside a whole number of books for people to listen that are listening to this podcast. That if you give me $10 towards that, so I'm putting $4 in my pocket every time, I'll send you a copy. As a thank you from me. Got to put, pay to play a little bit. If people don't pay, they usually don't pay attention. So I want some level of exchange, but I'll cover that. And I've set aside 500 books. So that, you know, it's essentially a couple of grand that I'm putting into listeners of this podcast. If they want to go and take advantage of that, once they're gone, they're gone. And you can put it in the show notes, but the URL is getpetesbook.com/eliteman. Okay. And anyone that goes there who listens to this, you can grab a copy of that for $10. I'll put in the other four. Don't go to Amazon and pay $24.95. And that is probably the best advice I could give in terms of how to deal with any situation. Yeah, not that you'd ever want to go to prison, but you've got a tough time because your spouse comes home and they're depressed, or your kid's being bullied at school, or you know, you're facing downsizing, or your industry's under threat. I don't care what it is. You've got a health challenge. Every technique that I had to pull out of the bag to keep me sane, safe, and above board and turn it into an incredible, you know, advantage is in the pages of that. And it's my gift to help as many people as I can.
Love it. Yeah, I'm definitely going to add that in the show notes, and we'll have the link right there so guys can check it out. It sounds like an incredible offer, man. And yeah, I appreciate you doing that, holding 500 copies for my guys to take advantage of. And I can't wait to get a copy myself, man. It's such a fascinating story. And I love what you've been able to do with it and, you know, turning your life around during that crazy time and coming back. And I just got to ask you this one more thing. Are you scared, or are you a little worried that this could happen again at some point, that you might be, you know, some crazy thing with finances comes up, or a civil lawsuit, or this or that, you might be thrown back into these dark days?
Yeah, well, once bitten, twice shy. I mean, we tend to hopefully learn the lessons. I mean, it's the old saying, you know, the biggest lesson of history is that, you know, we don't learn the lessons of history. But, you know, when something comes along at this level, you see it in relationships. People have the same relationship with different people because they don't learn the lessons of, you know, being impatient, or, you know, too judgmental, or, you know, whatever it may be, or lack of self-worth. But for me, I certainly learned some good lessons out of this that hopefully I don't have to resit the exam in Earth School. But guess what? What happens? The Olympics are every 4 years. Mm. You know, I'm sure my next graduation event will be presenting itself at some point downstream, because, you know, we live in a growth-centric experience. We don't live in a comfort-centric experience. And when we come to terms with that, again, we roll with the bends in the river of life. We don't try to fight the current. Yeah. So I'm ready.
Absolutely. Peter, thanks again, man, for coming on. Really do appreciate it. Guys, make sure you check out his book, The Inside Track. We'll link it up in the show notes. And that was awesome, man. Take care. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure's mine. Thank you. Keep doing what you're doing, Justin. You're an amazing guy.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I'd like you to do, and that's this. Subscribe to our podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast episodes and all of our world-class advice absolutely free. Subscribe now if you haven't already and become an Elite Man today. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an amazing review. We really do appreciate it.